The environmental sound you hear contains unwelcome species harmful to human health, the economy, and the environment. These non-native species can be found in ecosystems in Texas. Thanks very much for joining me. I'm Bob Franklin. This is Like It Is. Today we learn about invasive species here in Texas. My guest is Scott Summers of the Natural and Cultural Resources Management Branch, the Environmental Division, Directorate of Public Works at Fort Cavazos, Texas. Before bringing Scott on, what are invasive species? An invasive species is an introduced non-native organism, disease, parasite, plant, or animal that begins to spread or expand its range from the site of its original introduction and has the potential to cause harm to the environment, the economy, or to human health. Scott Summers is in the studio talking with us today, and we're going to get smarter because today's topic is invasive species. Help me to understand, what exactly is an invasive species, Scott?
Sir, Dr. Franklin, thanks for the introduction. Invasive species is a word we use to define the species that are not native to this area. And so because they're not native, they don't have the predators to keep them in check. And so in many cases here at Fort Cavazos and the surrounding area, invasive species can take over an area. And so as natural resources managers there at Fort Cavazos, we do mitigation efforts to help control these invasive species.
Talk a bit about the mitigation processes that you just mentioned. What are some of those?
Okay. Well, I'll use one invasive species that's been here. It wasn't intentionally brought in because we thought we were going to do something. It was actually brought in because we thought we were going to do something good, and that was the King Ranch bluestem grass. This is an invasive that in the 1950s, the biggest natural resources, or one of the biggest natural resources problems we had, was the loss of topsoil. And so the Soil Conservation Service discovered this grass, and it would stabilize soil banks fairly quickly. The Highway Department in Texas also used it, and so it got spread across Texas pretty fast. And what it did was it displaced our native grasses. And our native grasses are very beneficial to Fort Cavazos because they provide the type of habitat that's needed for our native grassland birds and other species. Some examples of those would be our savanna sparrows in the wintertime, vesper sparrows in the winter, but also our nesting dick sisals, northern bobwhites, and some others. We have grasshopper sparrows here, lark sparrows, meadowlarks, and so they require that, but the King Ranch bluestem was bad. And so what we do out at Fort Cavazos is we have procedures and conservation efforts in place to prevent the further spread of the King Ranch bluestem grass.
And so as a result, this is helpful to the general and the broader community?
It's helpful, yes, and because our whole broader community depends on Fort Cavazos for their livelihood. The last estimate that I read was about 500,000 people depend on Fort Cavazos in some way or another for their livelihood. So it's important that we keep Fort Cavazos as stable for the Army and its allies to train for decades to come, long after we're gone. And so it needs to be a viable landscape. And so what we do in my branch is we manage these invasive species, such as the King Ranch bluestem, so that we don't get more of it than we have. So we use prescribed fire. We have some summertime burns, but mostly winter burns. And these burns actually help promote native grasses. They definitely, by burning, we can create a landscape out on Fort Cavazos where the Army can train and reduce their risk of wildfires. Wildfires can be managed most of the time on ranges, but sometimes if the conditions are right, they can get too big. But the bottom line is these fires and the way we manage the landscape, we're trying to keep as many native grassland species as we can. And if we do that, not only do we keep imperiled grassland species off the consideration of the endangered species list, which could lead, it doesn't always, but it could lead to training restrictions. We don't want training restrictions. Out at Fort Cavazos, we're a partner with the Army, and we work to achieve the balance between the species needs and the Army training needs.
So I hear there's an economic component to it, and there's an environmental component to it. So you're balancing those two, the
Correct.
Economic. So what's been the success rate?
Well, I don't have any numbers right in front of me, but I can tell you that our live fire region, which is the region that gets most of the training fires and the prescribed fires, and I've been there for about 25 years, and I'm a member of that wildland fire team that helps lay the prescription burns down. But there's many of us. There's up to 16 of us on a given day. I can tell you that it hasn't it has helped our native species, or in at least sustained what we've had across these years that I've been here. We haven't had a loss of a lot of habitat due to invasives.
Okay. Well, we're going to talk about I'd like for you to talk about a few of the invasives just in general and how they impact negatively, you know, our area. If, in fact, they impact this Fort Cavazos region, Central Texas, perhaps maybe help our audience understand zebra mussels. Can you talk a bit preliminarily on what zebra mussels are?
Yes, Dr. Franklin, I can. Okay, so the zebra mussel is an invasive bivalve that was brought in here from, I believe, the Baltic Sea area. But it was brought in from over in the Asian continent up in that region. But it was brought here, and it was introduced around in the Great Lakes in the Northeast. And it's been spreading southward to Texas, and it is now here. It's in both the Stillhouse Hollow Lake and the Belton Lake area. And so because we have some military training that requires the use of bridging and putting boats out in the water and then moving them, we have some procedures in place that we have to get done, which is clean, drain, and dry. And so the same rules apply for boaters in Texas. You can go on the Texas Parks and Wildlife website. But the bottom line, one of the ways we have procedures for the military to clean, drain, and dry their boats if they need to use them again before they dry out on their own. But we also have procedures that relate to anglers that are out on the public, out on the water fishing. So if you're out in a lake at Fort Cavazos and you've got a bucket of minnows you're using as bait to catch some bass, and the bass aren't biting or whatever, and you decide to pick up and move your bait from that pond or lake to another one, that's illegal at Fort Cavazos. It's also illegal in Texas, from what I understand. But you have to actually destroy that bait. You can't introduce it into the pond that you've been fishing in and then leave. You also, worst case scenario, you can't move the water from that one to another one, because these bivalves, the zebra mussels, can be microscopic veliger forms. So I don't want to get into all the biology from the time they're hatched out into the adults, but these veligers, you might not see them in the water, but they're in the water. And so you could inadvertently introduce them into another water body. And we don't want to do that at Fort Cavazos.
Of course not. Of course not. I want to read for our audience the definition as provided by the federal government. The definition of invasive species. The federal government defines an invasive species as a species that is non-native or alien to the ecosystem and causes or is likely to cause economic or environmental harm or harm to human health. And the zebra mussel obviously would cause some degree of economic impact and problems for the ecosystem and in our particular community. The Nutria?
Sure, I'm going to talk a little bit about the nutria.
Found in Central Texas, going eastward, how is that negatively impacting our particular community with respect to the environment?
Well, it's like I said earlier in the podcast here, broadcast, I should say. all the non-native invasives can be bad, and none of them are ever good. But the degree to which they can damage the ecosystem can vary. Some non-natives get here, they don't fit in and they don't survive. It seems that the nutria, and this is what I know about nutria, they are in this region, they are at Fort Cavazos, but they don't seem to be devastating an aquatic ecosystem. They look a lot like a beaver. They're in the rodent family. A little historical perspective that you may have seen, Dr. Franklin, was the fact that they were brought in here in the fur trade back when a long, long time ago we didn't have the efficient ways of making clothes efficiently and you know, cost effective. So we did furs, and furs were controversial to certain people, but they were still, you know, we had winters, people wanted coats. And so the fur trade started. A lot of people I know, like my grandparents, 2-3 generations back, used to hunt some of the fur-bearing animals. Indeed, we still have a fur-bearing trapper's license where you basically buy a license to sell these things, but there's no market for it now because of the way we build clothes. But before that happened, before we got really good at clothing manufacturing, the farming industry, this is fur farms, that is, brought the nutria in from another area. And they, I was told and taught in my wildlife management coursework that there was a hurricane that destroyed some nutria farms in Louisiana. And when that happened, they spread. And they have wreaked some havoc on certain coastal ecosystems. And there are ways of the wildlife services, people outside of this region probably have trapping removal programs and so forth. But it was an incident, an accident, I should say. Nobody knew the hurricane was going to flatten the farm. When they got out, we couldn't undo it. And that's one of the biggest problems with exotic species introduction, invasive species introductions, is that once they're out, you can't take it back. We can't load up everything that got out and send it back to the continent it came from. Does that make sense?
Very much so, yes. I'm just interested, and I want our listeners to be interested, how did you get interested in your particular field of specialization?
Okay, well, that's a personal. I was fortunate to have grown up, I graduated high school at Copper's Cove High School. I grew up on a 400-acre cattle ranch that my granddad bought. He was in the Army Civil Service, spent a career here. And he ran cattle, and I used to have to help him with cattle, and I didn't like the cattle production. I liked the wild animals that took care of themselves. So we had deer and turkey, doves, and some other things, and I was really particularly interested in all those. But one winter, I believe it was in 1982, I watched a flock of 59 wild turkeys assemble on a creek bed near here, and I thought to myself, how could that many birds making that are that big that can make that much noise can possibly avoid predators? And then so I got really into everything I read about the science of wildlife management. And so I was a declared major before I went to college. And I went to what was then Southwest Texas State University in Texas State. There was a really good program down there led by Dr. John Backus. And he was focused on the fieldwork aspect. At the time, some of the universities around here weren't producing or weren't focused on the fieldwork aspect of wildlife management. And I think most people that get in this field are. Fieldwork's a lot of fun. It can be challenging. But that's how it all started for me. And when I got better at catching snakes and lizards and frogs. So it just went on from there. I never lost interest. And then fortunately, I was able to start my career in South Texas restoring a northern bobwhite. People know him as Quail for a landowner down there that had an interest in restoring his place. And then from there, I came back to Fort Hood, is now Fort Cavazos. And I've been there for about 25 years.
You're listening to The Public Affairs Program, Like It Is. My guest is Scott Summers of the Environmental Division, Directorate of Public Works, Fort Cavazos, Texas. Talk about the delicate balance that's necessary between, you know, human activity and, you know, the preserving of the ecological system and all, that delicate balance, just from your professional perspective, how important is that?
Well, I mean, the delicate balance is something that we're challenged with in our profession from a daily basis. You know, we try to tell people to do the right thing. Don't dump plants and animals out into the ecosystem. One of the things that people do, they think that they are doing some good by taking their fish bowl or their aquarium and dumping it in the local stream or pond. But what ends up happening, unfortunately, is those organisms may not make it very long. Most of them don't make it at all. But if they do make it, some exotic, again, you're risking exotic introductions that can harm the native plants and animals in the ecosystem. So the biggest points I try to make in my job as an outreach coordinator for our branch is to let people know some of the consequences that we have when we make these errors by introducing the wrong thing. I can go on and say right now it's illegal to introduce any plant or animal at Fort Cavazos. You can't do it. And if you get caught doing it, I've talked to our conservation law enforcement officers, our game wardens, say that just for starters, usually it's $1,000 fine, and they will catch you, and they do catch people. So my message to the public is if you have an aquarium, you want to call up some aquarium fish stores, and some of them I know have places you can take these fish back to if you're not, you know, you don't have them in your life goals anymore, and it'll be a much better outcome.
And this question you can only answer is, what's been your proudest moment as someone who is helping to preserve the ecosystem, the conservation of our particular area? What's been your proudest moment and why?
Well, I think my personal proudest moment, if you could it's hard to answer that because I have so many. I have a career where I really don't consider it work, even though it's hard and there's long hours and harsh working conditions at times. I can tell you that I think it was a team effort. You know, I played high school football at Copper's Cove. I know about team sports and individual sports. I can tell you that our branch, we have about a dozen or so biologists, and they are just loaded with experience. And so we work together very well. Our wildlife management team, I thought I was going to talk a lot about that today. There's about half of those are that team. They alone had over 130 years of combined experience. But we work together. The wildlife management team, the endangered species management team, is the other half of the natural and cultural resources branch. And, of course, we have cultural. And that's a different subject from what we'll talk about today. But I can tell you that we work together with a lot of hard work, planning, and passion, and we helped recover what was then the endangered black-capped vireo. It's a little songbird that comes here to nest each spring in parts of Texas, northern Mexico, and Oklahoma. The Fish and Wildlife Service listed that bird in 1987 as endangered. It recovered it in 2018. Due in part because of the large population we recovered here at Fort Cavazos. And so we recovered it by habitat protection, habitat enhancement, and then, of course, the trapping of the brown-headed cowbirds. It's a nest parasite that's native. We had to have permits years ago. We don't have to have permits now, but we do have to follow the terms and conditions set forth by a federal order called the Cowbird Depredation Order. But we trap enough of those, keep them out of the habitat, and then we release them at the end of the spring. But we don't have the nest parasitism. Nest parasitism, the cowbird ends up laying its egg, and the vireo, the black-cat vireo, raises a cowbird instead of its own young. So
I was going to ask you, and you kind of touched on it, but do you have federal and state backing in terms of enforcement of these particular regulations that, yes, are on the books? Could you talk about one or two of those, please?
Yeah, well, we have the Endangered Species Act that we abide by, and our leadership at the branch division and even the directorate level has built great relations with the regulatory agency, the United States Fish and Wildlife Service. They entrust our leadership to hire the right people and get things going. And they've done a good job working together. We've actually reduced the training restrictions to zero related to endangered species. I think that's a big part. We've had successful collaboration at the higher levels of management. In fact, when they delisted the black cat vireo in 2018, you asked me my proudest moment.
Yes.
I was proud to be a part of that team, but all the way up to our director level at the Garrison. And so it's just a great success story. Sometimes you get this many people, this many professionals, it's hard to collaborate as efficiently as we've done across the last few decades. But I would say that was it. But they do a good job of working with our regulators, ensuring our regulators that we are doing the right thing, and so we don't have to go into painful consultations where that could result into training restrictions or something or other that we don't want.
Can we talk briefly about the fire ants, red fire ants? Talk a bit about the problem that they pose.
So the red imported fire ants, they were brought in here from a ship ballast from South America. They were dumped in the Mobile, Alabama port somewhere, and that was in the 1930s, and they have expanded to include most of Texas, I guess. The thing that limits these ants is the arid environments out in the deserts of West Texas, or where there's not enough rainfall to keep them going. But here at Fort Cavazos, they're ubiquitous across the landscape. They moved through here, from my estimate, because I grew up right outside of Fort Cavazos. They moved through our ranch in 1982, and they are carnivorous in nature. They eat animal materials, and they eat small insects and small mammals, small birds. And so these ants are, if you've ever been outside and been stung by a bunch of red imported fire ants, you'll never forget it, because they usually wait to one tells all the others, okay, now, and then it just wallops you. But they were, in my opinion, responsible for the declines of a lot of our ground-dwelling fauna. I remember cottontail rabbits, horny toads, Texas horn lizards, if you will, they were in abundance, and a bunch of snakes. Bull snakes were in abundance, coach whips. And some of these species are still around. In fact, we have a handful, I believe, still of the Texas horn lizard. And we have all the snakes, but we just don't have them in the abundance anymore. And so the red imported fire ant competes with other native ant species. So here we go again, an invasive species story, where the invasives have displaced the natives. And I'm not aware of any ant species that they drove out, but it wouldn't surprise me if there's areas here and there where they drove them out through competition, just competition for food and space. They weren't good. Fire ants were one of the worst things that happened in my short 52 years of life. And so, but they have been responsible for the loss of a lot of ground-dwelling fauna. But with any invasive species, they often will escalate and exponentially, and then they'll crash a little bit, and then they plateau. I think we're probably in that plateau area.
With red ants?
With the red imported fire ants. Okay. And so there has been a lot of research done in Texas to introduce their forward fly, which is their native parasite. So they went down, these entomologists from UT Breckenridge Field Lab went to South America, got these, studied these forward flies in a controlled environment for many, many years to make sure that if they introduce this forward fly, they won't introduce another ecological problem that we're up against. So they introduced this in Texas. And the last report I had, these forward fly experts estimate 4 million acres in Texas has them established. And so maybe they will level the playing field and provide some good news for those of us who hasn't had good experience or haven't had good experiences with the red imported fire ant.
So my question to you, what would you like listeners to know about the job that you do and the job and the team that you are currently doing? Why is it important that what you're doing? What would be your take-home message to listeners who would want to know Why is all this important to them, and why should it matter?
Well, I think just having, I don't know if you call it ecological literacy, but just to know the importance of why we need as much biodiversity as we can possibly manage across our landscape. It would benefit anybody who likes to drink clean water or who likes to breathe clean air. These ecosystem services that we all are connected to each day for our own survival, that'd be one message. The other message is I would like to just say I'm very proud to be one little part of a team of natural resource professionals at Fort Cavazos that are work every day, every season, every year to ensure that we're putting our best foot forward with the conservation dollars we're handed to make sure that we can have as much of this biodiversity and as we can possibly have on our landscape, and also so we can do it in a context where the military can train in any way they need to prepare for any mission they have going forward.
Thank you.
Thank you, Dr. Franklin.
Yes, sir.
My guest today was Scott Summers of the Environmental Division, Directorate of Public Works, Fort Cavazos, Texas. I'm Bob Franklin. I'll be back next week with 30 more minutes of good conversation on another edition of Like It Is.
Native Voice One, the Native American Radio Network.